Good evening. We're ready to roll. Got my new recorder. I need you to open up to page 413. As you know, Kedarki Bakodesh, as I do all the time. Before we look at this week's Torah portion, we're going to look at the end of last week's Torah portion. It happens to be that I am not doing this randomly, but because many of the commentaries insist that you cannot understand the beginning of this week's Torah portion without the end of last week's Torah portion. What is it that happened at the end of last week's Sidra? Not a complicated question. What happened at the end of last week's Torah portion? The Ten Commandments were given. The Ten Commandments were listed. We are actually very, very shortly after that. In fact, right after the Ten Commandments are given, there's this brief story about the people, what the people's experience. They saw the thunder and the flames. And then Moshe approaches and goes into the thick cloud that has settled onto the mountain. And he ends up going up for 40 days and 40 nights. If we have a chance, we'll talk about some of the chronology of that as it happens. But this comes immediately after that. There is a parsha break. If you notice, there's a stuma, a closed break, a tab. And then we immediately begin this. Will someone read it out loud for us, starting from verse 19? Go ahead, Sybil.
Hashem said to Moses, "So shall you say to the children of Israel, you have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. You shall not make images of what is with me. Gods of silver and gods of gold shall you not make for yourselves. An altar of earth shall you make for me, and you shall slaughter near it your elevation offerings and your peace offerings, your flock and your herd. Wherever I permit my name to be mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. And when you make for me an altar of stones, do not build them hone, for you will have raised your sword over it and desecrated it. You shall not ascend my altar on steps, so that your nakedness will not be uncovered."
Okay, so this is the very end of the Torah portion. There are a number of mitzvot that are mentioned in here. It's a little bit of a curious section, a little not clear exactly how it all hangs together or what it's doing here right after the Ten Commandments. I mentioned it to you in your homework, so I asked you to think about this a little bit. The question is, what is so important about this? Why does this come immediately after the theophany, after God reveals himself on Mount Sinai? Why does this happen right away?
You say theophany?
Yes.
That is awesome.
It's an awesome word, right?
Yeah.
Theophany means the revelation of God's presence.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. So wait, an epiphany is different how? Sorry, that's the way I
think it's an idea.
What's the word?
Well, epiphany means a revelation also, but theophany is specifically related to God.
To God, this way.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Okay. So, I'm going to suggest two ideas for what's so important about this section here. Let's just make sure we understood what's going on here. God says to the children of Israel, "You've seen that I've spoken to you from heaven." Meaning he's specifically referring to the fact that there was just a theophany, right? And then he tells them, "You shall not make images of what is with me. Gods of silver and gods of gold shall you not make for yourselves." Okay, so we know that you shouldn't make idols. Okay, then he tells him, "You shall make me an altar." Could be an altar of earth, or it could be an altar of stones. And if it is an altar of stones, what's the limitation?
It can't have been man-made.
They can't be cut with steel, with metal. They can't be metal-cut stones. Okay?
Is that why we don't have those?
He says here, it is an article of war. If you have raised your sword over the altar, you have desecrated the altar. Okay? And then finally he says, "You shall not ascend my altar by steps," which I asked you about in the homework. Why do you have to ascend by ramp instead of by steps? The Torah says, so your nakedness will not be uncovered upon it. Rashi mentions that when you are stepping up and you're wearing a toga or a skirt, you might reveal your skinny legs, and that it might not be very tanua. It might be not very, very modest. There may be other explanations for that as well. But these are the mitzvot that are brought here. Now, I'm going to give you two explanations for what these might mean. One is Rav Hirsch. We're going to talk a lot about Rabbi Samson Raphael Hirsch, who was some people call him the first modern Orthodox rabbi. Whether that's true or not, I don't know exactly, but he was a very great and famous German rabbi in the 19th century. And we're going to talk a lot about him tonight. And he wrote a commentary on the Torah. It was written in German, translated into English. It is available. And it's very, very worth reading. Very, very good stuff. He suggests the following. He says, the Torah finds it very specifically to mention, after the giving of the Aseret Hadibrot, the 10 whatever they are, right? Three mitzvot, or three categories of mitzvot, that are what we call certain the cardinal mitzvot for which you have to sacrifice your life. In Hebrew, they're called Yehareg v'al Yavor. Rather, you should die than transgress these mitzvot. Have you ever heard of these three unforgivable sins?
Oh, yeah.
Three sins, right? Anybody know what they are? First one, Jen?
Murder.
Murder, correct. One is murder. If someone puts a gun to your head and says, I will kill you if you don't kill your friend, you take the bullet. Because murder is a sin that you should die for rather than commit. Yes?
Sexual immorality. Or certain types of sexual immorality.
Sexual immorality is the next one. Meaning, in all other words, if you say, if you are a married man and they say, sleep with this other man's wife, otherwise I will kill you, you should die rather than commit adultery. And the third?
Idols.
Idolatry. Good. You guys are pros. Idolatry. These are the three, right? Avodah zarah, the worship of idols, so to speak, or strange worship. Shfichut damim, the spilling of innocent blood. And gilui arayot, sexual immorality, we'll call it. Okay, these are the three things. According to Rav Hirsch, these are the three that are mentioned here. The first one says that you've seen that I spoke to you from heaven. Do not make other images of God. That is idol worship, right? Number two is the murder, because you are not allowed to use the sword in order to cut the stones in order to make the altar, referring to the idea that articles of war, things that are used to kill other people, have no place in the worship of God. That's number two. And number three, what?
Isn't an altar inherently used for like animals slaughtered?
Yes, but animals and human beings are different. If you kill a cow, you have not violated the commandment of thou shalt not murder.
So how do they kill the cow if not with like an implement of war?
This is referring to the stones. And first of all, it's referring to the stones, not the animals. Second of all, it happens to be true that the animals are not killed on the altar. The animals actually are killed in another place, and there is a discussion about it in the Talmud, but basically the killing of the animal is not considered to be part of the divine service. Mm-hmm. Now, whenever we talk about halachic things, there's always what's called a nafka mina. There's always a practical growth, outgrowth that comes from it. The way we know that the slaughtering the animal is not considered to be a part of the service is because a Kohen does not have to do it. It can be. It is a prerequisite, obviously, to offer it. You don't put live animals on the flame, but you do. You kill it as a separate prerequisite part of the service. Okay. And thirdly, gilui arayot, sexual immorality, is reflected or is mentioned here, is hinted at by saying so that your nakedness will not be uncovered. That word, your nakedness shall be uncovered, is the same phrase that we use when we talk about sexual immorality. So Rav Hirsch suggests that these three things, and these are very, very important things, are the only things that a human being voluntarily gives up his life for in the sanctification of God's name, which is a mitzvah, actually. If someone threatens to kill you unless you profane God's name, unless you worship an idol, right? It is a mitzvah to sanctify God's name by being a martyr. This is interesting. The definition of a martyr is one who does not want to die, but dies on principle because in refusing to violate his principles, others kill him. So the definition that's used by, for instance, of martyrs for those who blow themselves up in order to kill other people is fundamentally wrong, because a person who blows a homicide bomber or suicide bomber wants to die. They are the ones that cause their death. They're not standing up for a principle by which others will kill them unless they violate their principles. They actually kill themselves and others. They're not martyrs, they're just murderers. Okay, just pointing that out. Yeah, I know. Okay, so that's Rav Hirsch. That's how Rav Hirsch says it. There is another way to look at it, which I think is actually quite interesting, and it's mentioned by a number of commentators, among them Ibn Ezra, who says that basically what we're going to start doing from here and going all the way through Mishpatim is reiterating the Aseret HaDibrot. Remember, we talked about the fact that Rav Saadia Gaon said that the Aseret HaDibrot are the core principles of all the 613 commandments, and that you can actually take all the 613 and divvy them up into the Ten Commandments, the Aseret HaDibrot. So, see, it's a hard habit to break. Right? So, according to that, What we're going to start doing now, as we get into the part of the Torah that talks more about halacha, about Jewish law, is we're going to start recapitulating the Eser Hadibrot. So let's think about how it works. Here's how we'll start here with this. The first thing is, you have seen that I have spoken to you from heaven. That corresponds to Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am Hashem, your God. Commandment number one. You shall not make images of what is with me. Gods of silver and gods of gold shall you not make. That is the second commandment. You shall have no other gods before me. Right? Then we talk about making an altar, and it says in verse 21, wherever I permit my name to be mentioned, I shall come to you and bless you. This is referring to the appropriate way of using Hashem's name, as opposed to commandment number three, which is do not take Hashem's name in vain. Right? And then, perhaps, when we talk about swords and killing, that may be referring to, we skip a few commandments and go to lo tirtzach, do not murder. And perhaps, related to nakedness, we talk about lo tinaf, you shall not commit adultery. So that's them. Those are five of the commandments mentioned right there. What we'll see as we go forward is that the rest of them are mentioned shortly afterwards. For instance, what is the first mitzvot that we find in this week's Torah portion, in Mishpatim? What's the first section? It's the first whole section of commandments is about the
Jewish
servant. I prefer the word servant. It's more appropriate to what their job actually is. The Jewish servant. The Jewish servant is allowed to be a servant for 6 years, and in the seventh year, they go free. In other words, what commandment is it recapitulating?
Shabbat.
Fundamental freedom. Now also, it happens to be that the whole institution of Jewish servitude reminds us that you are not allowed to be slaves to human masters. That's why you go free in the seventh year. Just like the whole point of the Exodus from Egypt was to say, you are servants to me alone, to God alone, and not to human beings. That's the whole message of the Exodus. So it recapitulates Shabbat by talking about the same idea of Shabbat. Shabbat also refers back, on one hand, to the creation of the world. I know you've been discussing this with Rabbi Wilds on the Shabbat idea, right? That on one hand, Shabbat talks about the creation of the world. God did it for 6 days and rested. And on the other hand, it refers back to the freedom of the Jewish people when they left Egypt. All this makes sense? Give me a nod if you're on board with me, right? Okay, so that's that. Let's skip forward just a little bit. If we go to verse 12, page 421. One who strikes a man so that he dies shall surely be put to death. That is the commandment of lo tirtzach, do not murder. Okay, let's go to verse 15. One who strikes his father or mother shall surely be put to death. Clearly referring to honoring your parents. Verse 16. One who kidnaps a man and sells him. Clearly referring to thou shalt not steal, which we said refers to stealing human beings. Okay? And then what we do is we go on and do a whole lot of other things that are not exactly murder. Hurting someone, damaging their property, all those kinds of things. But eventually, we'll come to... Let's turn to chapter 22, verse 7. It's page 427. We're talking here about a thief. If the thief is not found, you see it, bottom of 427? If the thief is not found, then the householder shall approach the court that he had not laid his hand upon his fellow's property. In other words, we begin to talk about court proceedings in which one testifies. And we know already that it says, the ninth commandment, do not bear false witness. The only one that's a little tricky is lo tachmod, the tenth one. It says, you shall not covet. It's a little unclear where it fits into here. Some commentaries argue that everything here is under lo tachmod, and that actually the reason it was put last is because it encompasses everything. You would never have to deal with hitting, kidnapping, stealing, testifying in court, any of these things, if it did not begin with somebody coveting that which belonged to someone else. In which case, the whole thing actually is subsumed under lo tachmod, thou shalt not covet.
Crime of passion. Hit somebody, strike them?
Well, crimes of passion. Most passion is because you're passionate about something that someone else has. Most of the time. A lot of times. Now, it could be that. But basically, the idea then is the reason we have this section immediately following the Aseret HaDibra, and the reason it goes into the Mishpatim, is to teach us the application of the Aseret HaDibra. The Aseret HaDibra were given at this theophany around Mount Sinai. They were given in this one big moment. But then afterwards, the Jewish people, they learn the basics, if you will, and then they sit down later and they have to study it. Like, this is what makes yeshiva boys happy. Yeshiva boys are learning about the Exodus from Egypt and Moshe's story and the stories of the Avos, and they're like, you know, come on, let's get to the good stuff. Because yeshiva boys want to study the intricacies of the law, and this is all of this. Half the Talmud is based on this parsha, right? There's so many, many, many halachot in here. So they get into this. Now you can roll up your sleeves and really get into the study of Judaism in here. So the Jewish people too actually sat at, we'll learn about this more, they actually sat around the mountain of Sinai for almost a year. And what did they do? They learned the Torah, as much of it as was available to them. Which was, of course, only up in the story up to where they were. But they learned these halachot, and they learned other things. They had a lot to learn. And they studied. They became students of the Torah. So the Aseret HaDibrot are that first moment of excitement. It's like the Shabbaton when you like get, you know, really excited about learning more in your Judaism. And then Mishpatim is the fellowship, basically. Okay.
Wait, five books was up until here?
No, there's a whole discussion which I want to get into now, but obviously, if the Jewish people are now at a moment in time when they're sitting around Mount Har Sinai, so the part of the Torah that deals with them traveling through the desert for 40 years and all that kind of stuff, it hasn't happened yet. So they're obviously not able to study those parts of the Torah because they're not written or they're not available to them.
So they're blank.
Well, there's some discussion about exactly how it works. But basically, whether they're written or not written, they could have been written prophetically. You know, Hashem could have told like Moshe what was going to happen or written it down and not revealed it to Moshe. The point is they're not studying that part. If they're studying anything, they're probably studying Mishpatim and maybe some other things. Very likely they could be, they later on they get mitzvot, like the whole book of Vayikra. They get the laws of the sacrifices and the laws of sexual morality and the laws of keeping a holy camp. All of these things are taught to them. They have plenty to study even if they don't have the whole thing. Okay, now, here's something else interesting. There is something else. Most of these commandments were taught to Moshe while he was up on the mountain. Moshe goes up on the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. He gets the Torah and he comes down. And then there's some trauma. We'll get to the golden calf, all this other stuff that happens. But more or less, once the smoke clears, they sit down and they learn the Torah. And these are the commandments that he got. But these are not the only commandments he got. What else did Moshe get when he went up to the mountain?
The
tablets are the Aseret HaDibrot, right? And he also gets all of these commandments, which he teaches them, right? Some of it is written and some of it is oral. But he also gets the next parsha. I don't know who's looked forward. The next parsha, which starts in chapter 25, is the parsha of Truma, which are the laws of the building of the tabernacle, the building of the Mishkan. So Moshe also gets all the rules for building the Mishkan. He learns how to make the menorah, how to make the table that had the bread on it, how to make the altars, how to hang the curtains. We're going to deal with that next week. But he also gets that. So I want to share with you something interesting. If I had this would be a good time to have the whiteboard. So we're just going to try to do it in the air here.
But, real quick.
Yeah.
What is tangibly there for the year that they're studying at this point? At this point? No, later they're studying for a year.
That's a good question. I'll try to say it as simply as I can. The way things are written in the Torah does not always accord with the way they happened in the order in which they happened. So the laws of Mishpatim are written here for a conceptual reason. They follow the Aseret HaDibrot. However, in the actual way it happened in history, Moshe first had to go up the mountain. Actually, it's an argument among the sources, so maybe I'll duck the question.
You refer to ask the rabbi.
According to Rashi, he gave it to them before he went up the mountain. According to Ramban, he gave them to him after he came down. So it is a major. It would be a major question. Rashi and the Ramban read the whole story in a different order. These are two different stories. So it's a little complicated. I'm going to duck it more than that. Okay? Fine. Here's what's interesting. Let's take four blocks of story. I'm going to zoom out on the Google map here of the book of Shemot. We're going to zoom out to a much broader vantage point, and we're going to look at four major blocks that are going to happen. Here's the way they go. You should write this down. Okay? Chapter 19 and 20. Are Matan Torah. Now, if you look on your vocabulary sheet, I gave you this word. It's number 5.
Another sheet. Another
under my recording here. Okay. Matan Torah. Number 5 on the sheet. Chapters 19 and 20 are Matan Torah. Matan Torah means the gift of the Torah, or the giving of the Torah. Matana is what you want on Hanukkah. You want a matana, a gift. Matan Torah, the giving of the Torah. Okay? That's chapter 19 and 20. Chapter 21, 22, and 23 are Mishpatim. That is vocabulary word number 1.
Chapter
21, 22, 23 are Mishpatim. Mishpatim mean statutes or a certain kind of laws. We'll get into what exactly they are soon. But they're a group of laws that deal about the relationships between human beings. Justice. The word for justice in Hebrew is mishpat. Okay? So there are laws about justice between two human beings. Two human beings go to court, they're arguing about money. Mishpat is jurisprudence. It's the justice. That's 21, 22, 23. Chapter 24, which is still in this week's Torah portion, is back to Matan Torah. It is the conclusion of the giving of the Torah. And it's actually in chapter 24 that two very important things happen. One is the Jewish people say Na'aseh v'nishma, which is a very famous phrase, which hopefully we'll talk about still tonight. We shall do and we shall listen, right? And it's when the Torah mentions that Moshe goes up onto the mountain for 40 days and 40 nights. All that happens in chapter 24. Chapter 25 is the commandment to build the Mishkan, the tabernacle. Okay, so you see the structure, four major blocks. Giving of the Torah, laws between man and man, giving of the Torah, the Mishkan.
So Mishkan and tabernacle are the same?
Yes, Mishkan and tabernacle are the same.
Now,
what's interesting here is two things. First of all, the giving of the Torah is divided up into two parts, which is very curious. Second of all, the Mishpatim and the Mishkan are separated from each other. Now, I'm not going to answer, I don't want to deal with the first question now, why Matan Torah is divided into two parts. It's a very complicated question dealing with what Josh was asking about. But it's very interesting to me that the Mishpatim and the Mishkan are separated, and I'll tell you why they're different and why you might want to put a separation between them. They reflect two different areas of Jewish law. Mishpatim are bein adam lachaviro, between human beings, between a person and their friend. Right? And the Mishkan, which is God's house, where God dwells within the community, is bein adam lamakom, between a human being and God. Where have we seen this dichotomy before?
In the
Aseret HaDibrot. We saw that the first five are Ben Adam LaMakom, between a human being and God, and the second five are between a human being and his friend, or her friend. So we have, again, in recapitulating, in bringing out, again, more of the juice of the Aseret HaDibrot, we see a continuing distinction between the area of religious life that's between a human being and God, and the area of religious life between a human being and other human beings. Now, the nature of Mishpatim is something that we discussed before. Let me try and bring you back to remind you. When the Jewish people left the Yamsuf, when they left the Red Sea, remember they traveled for 3 days without water, and they came to where?
Marah.
The place of bitter waters, right? And it was at the place of the bitter waters, Moshe throws the tree into the water, sweetens the water. And then what does it say that Moshe gave to the Jewish people?
Laws.
Specifically, two kinds of laws. Chok u'mishpat. Now, if you look at 1 and 2 on your vocab list, mishpat is the singular of mishpatim, which is our Torah portion. Mishpat means one law. It says he gave them a law, a statute. And here is mishpatim. It's just plural. And chok is a law also. It's a different kind of a law. And when you pluralize it, it's chukim. So that's, mishpatim and chukim are two different kinds of laws. We will try to define what the difference is between them a little bit later. But at Marah, at the place of bitter waters, Moshe gives them a law and a statute. We talked about it a couple weeks ago. I think it was 2 weeks ago, right? Okay, so it's not the first time that we've come across this. We talked about the idea that when the Jewish people came into the desert, they needed to create systems for how they were going to deal with each other. They were scared. They were uncertain. A lot of stuff was going on, and there was a real opportunity to bring out the worst of people. So Moshe created, according to Ibn Ezra, Chok u'Mishpat, he created a whole system for the people to feel like their needs were being met, like there was a structure and there were rules. As part of the question we discussed last week about when did Yitro come to visit Moshe, Moshe was there. He had created a whole legal structure. People were coming to him for judgment, and Yitro helped him create a system of judges, right? Was this happening at before the Torah was given? And we know it's possible because he had already given them Chok u'Mishpat, he'd given them some laws. Or did it happen after the giving of the Torah when clearly they had Mishpatim, they had a lot of laws? So either one is a possibility. So I'll share with you a beautiful insight that I saw in the name of the Oznaim LaTorah. Oznaim LaTorah is I don't remember his name, but he's a commentary, contemporary commentary, 20th century commentator. He says something very interesting. He says the whole idea, Oznaim LaTorah, ears for the Torah. But Oznaim doesn't only mean ears, it also means a handle. So a commentary can imagine itself as a tool by which you learn how to carry the Torah with you. I think that's what he means. You know? And ozen can mean a handle or something that you carry. Something like. Okay, so there's Naim Latorah says something very interesting. He says, at the beginning, before the Mishpatim, they get a commandment to build what kind of altar?
A traveling altar?
No, one that you can't, one for sacrifices and one that you can't cut.
One made of stones, or earlier than that, earth. Made of earth. What kind of altar do they build when they build the Mishkan?
One made of gold, isn't it?
Gold. So as Naim LaTorah says, very interesting. First Hashem gives them the commandment to build a wood and stone altar. And then later on he gives them the commandment to build a gold altar. And in between the two of them, what does he put? Mishpatim. The laws of how human beings should treat each other. Justice. How you relate to your peers. Right? Because when he first gives him the altar, it's very nice. It's a religious, you're going to serve God, and you're going to serve God with stones and dirt. Who cares about stones and dirt? Nobody owns stones and dirt. But when you're going to come to build an altar to God that's made out of gold and silver, right, and precious materials, you better already know how to treat your fellow human being, or you will never be able to build an altar to God made of something that's valuable. Before you get to the gold and silver, which everybody wants to steal from each other, you better learn how to treat your fellow human being. Otherwise, you'll never get there. You'll never be able to worship God with gold and silver if you don't learn first how to treat your friends. I think it's a very beautiful insight. I like it. Okay. So good. Any questions? Onwards. I've lulled you into a stupor. Okay. Let us look at the very beginning of our Torah portion. Flip back to Mishpatim. Sybil, read for us chapter 21, verse 1. Just verse 1. We're not going to do any more than verse 1 right now.
Verse 1.
Just verse 1.
And these are the ordinances that you shall place before them.
They translated it differently here than they translated it last time. Fine. These are the ordinances. I have two questions on this verse that I'm going to share with you, but I want to hear if you have any questions on this verse first. Actually, I have three comments to make about this verse. What do you think about this verse?
Strange.
What's strange about it?
Jesus, ordinances, statutes that you should put before them. Why does it have to be put before them?
Okay, so Eitan's question is, what do you mean before them? Why do you have to put them before them? It's kind of a little bit of an odd way of putting it. How would you say it?
Upon them.
that you should teach them. Put before them seems a little stilted, maybe, perhaps, could just be a language thing. What else?
And before them, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, the wording also makes you think that it's more important than other things, because if you put something before something else.
Meaning like worded, before meaning priority.
No, it's like the it's translated, so it's probably not how it sounds like in Hebrew.
Okay. What else about this verse? Wendy?
Yeah.
Who is the you to whom we're speaking? Okay? Fair question. It does not specify. We kind of know, but anytime it doesn't specify, there's room for doubt. Fair question. Yeah, what else? You're thinking, that's good. I like the detailed, you know, pry every letter apart in here. Yeah. What about those? Right. What about those ordinances? Yeah. Okay, that's good. I like that question. I didn't think of that one.
That's kind of what I was thinking when I was saying yeah? Place before them. Like that these, why are they saying before them, like before the Ten Commandments? Like what do they mean by before them?
Well, yeah, so it's a series of questions about why these and not others? What about the ones that come after this? What about the ones that come before? Why are we starting with these? Fair question. What else, Kathy?
I'm just looking back. So, no. I was going to say, if it's Hashem speaking, the Hakam of Mountains. Never mind.
Anybody else?
This is Hashem speaking to Moshe.
That's right, Hashem is speaking to Moshe. Anything else?
This isn't really... Okay, now this is like another point that could be... when it starts with N, so it's almost like...
Good.
...is referring to we already did these and now we're doing these.
And is an excellent question, very important question. This is the first Rashi in the Parsha. So let's review. Here are my issues with this verse. First, yeah, go ahead.
What's going on right now? Like, where are they? Like,
they're at Mount Sinai.
They're at Mount Sinai.
Yeah, more than that, I don't want to get into the details.
Okay,
they're at Mount Sinai.
So they left.
Here is the story. And these are the ordinances. So Stacy's question is first, why does it say and? Is it just a stylistic thing, or is it somehow what would and do?
Links it to the previous.
Links it to the previous, whatever came before, which is why we are always turning back. Right? So this is linking it to the previous, which we already know it's linking it to the previous. We know it's linking it to the previous thing, which is talking about the altars and not taking God's name in vain and all that stuff. We also know that it's connecting it to the Ten Commandments, to the Aseret HaDibrot. Okay, so we know that. And these are the ordinances. Now, ordinances, the word is mishpatim. What is not mentioned?
Chukim.
Last time we referred to these, when in Mara, the place of bitter waters, it said he gave them a chok umishpat, a law and a statute. Here it just says one. What happened to the chukim? Lastly, it says place before them, instead of saying teach to them. It says you shall place it before them rather than teach it to them. So we can see that if we read carefully, there's always a lot to think about in the Torah, and if we know what we're thinking about, then we'll appreciate Rashi, who I brought for you, if you flip the page. Okay, we flip the page, we'll see the Rashi. Can I get a new reader to read? We did the verse already now, I brought it here for you, to read the Rashi for us. Go ahead.
So, these are the laws. Wherever the word...
I'm sorry. I copied this off of the website that I sent you guys, and I didn't notice that it doesn't work that well right here. Wherever the word ve'ela and these.
Okay. And these is used, it disqualifies.
Sorry, I did it wrong. Wherever the word ela is used without a vav, meaning ela. Go ahead.
Is used, it disqualifies that which preceded it. But the word
ve'ela
is a continuation of that which preceded it.
Which is exactly your point, Stacy. That basically, if it said, and these are the mishpatim, it would have said this is a new thing. But if it says, if it said these are the mishpatim, it's a new thing. But if it says, and these are the mishpatim, it's a continuation of what came before. Okay, how does Rashi read it?
Here too.
Ve'ela, and these.
Conveys that just as the preceding words, the Ten Commandments, were received from Sinai,
these following laws also were received from Sinai.
So what Rashi says here is that the way that it continues them is to show on a certain level that these mishpatim are just as important as the Aseret HaDibrot. Just as the Aseret HaDibrot, the 10 utterances, were given at Sinai, so too these mishpatim were given at Sinai. They are the same importance. Either you might think they're not, but we're trying to say that laws between human beings are very, very important. Or we're going to say the reason they're just as important as the Aseret HaDibrot is because, in fact, they are the extension of the Aseret HaDibrot. Very good. Now, what's the second Rashi? Let's skip to the next Rashi.
Yeah. So if you were doing like what's bothering Rashi on this and you were working backwards, you would say his problem is why does it say and? Is that correct?
Good question.
We don't need to go into that. I was just trying to... I guess I was thinking about it.
No, you're asking the right question. What's bothering Rashi here? Could that really be what's bothering Rashi?
So he doesn't write anything down unless he has a problem, right?
Correct. I don't think his problem... See, it's not so easy to figure out what's bothering Rashi. I don't think his problem is the Vav, because there are a lot of Vavs in the Torah, but honestly, a lot of Vavs. I think his problem is why are these the first set of mitzvot, or why are these... I think his problem is... Who said it? Who said the problem that their problem was like... It's Sybil's problem. Why these mitzvot now? I think that's his problem. And his answer, I think that's really his problem, and his answer then becomes complicated, like if he really answers it or not. But okay, anyway, let's go on. Next Rashi. Go ahead, Stacey.
God said to Moshe, do not allow it to enter your mind to say, I will teach them a section of the law 2 or 3 times until it becomes fluent in their mouths exactly as it is taught. But I will not bother myself to make them understand the reasons for each thing and its explanation.
Yeah, I mean, come on. You could teach the fellows Parsha all night, but can you really make sure that they understand you? Is it possible to know that they've walked out and they understand what the heck you were talking about? Sometimes I am not sure. I say, what can you do? I'll teach the Torah. If they understand me, they understand me. If not, they don't understand me. Unfortunately, I'm not allowed to do that.
It therefore states that you shall set before them like a set table with everything ready to be eaten for the person.
In other words, someone comes over to your house to eat a meal. You can say, the fridge is yours. Make yourself at home. There's, vegetables and fruits in there. There's meat in the fridge. You can do whatever you want to do. Make yourself a meal. Make yourself at home. Or you can cook a beautiful meal for them. Make fresh challah and chulent and whatever it is you make and put it into a nice tray and put it on the table with a tablecloth and sit everybody down. All you got to do is pick up your fork to eat the beautiful meal that's in front of you. Right? So the burden that he's putting here, that you shall set before them, means you have to make the Torah ready to eat. You have to prepare it. You have to set it out. You have to get it ready. You have to put it into bite-sized pieces so that the students... Now, we can flip this on its head in another place and talk about what a student's responsibility is. Here we're talking about Moshe's responsibility. And Moshe's responsibility is not to teach the Torah, but to set it before them. It is a very higher burden. We're not content to say, you get up at your podium and talk, and they take what they take. Moshe has to...
make it accessible.
That's right. He has to put it into the vessel from which it can be eaten. Not require them to take steps that they are not ready to take. Which, there are different ways of looking at this, but one way of looking at this is, if your students are beginners, you have to present the Torah in one way. If your students are intermediates, you may require more of them. You have to put it into the vessels they're ready to have. And that kind of... If your students are advanced, you present it to them in a different way. Every student has his own way they need to eat it. You need to present the meal that it needs, that is ready to be eaten. Yeah. There is a Rashi. I actually didn't put it in here. The next Rashi, the way Midrash often does it is by, when it says lifnehem, before them, the Midrash says, before them, but not before who else.
Right.
So it says, before them, you should put the judgments should go before them, meaning Jews, and you shouldn't take your court cases to non-Jewish courts. It is a different Midrash. It's a relevant Midrash, But it's a whole different.
In the Rashi.
Yeah, it's in the Rashi, and it is there. This, we actually learn the prohibition against litigating against a fellow Jew in a non-Jewish court from this.
Okay.
Which is true, but it's like a whole separate topic. There's a lot in the Torah, and there's a lot in this one verse.
Yeah, in the commentary that I read, I don't even remember it mentioning anything about this whole understanding. It makes sense.
Well, if you just read the Stone Chumash, so you're getting an anthologized and edited version of what Rashi says. If you read Rashi himself, which is what I copied out of the off the website here, then you get what Rashi says. I did. I sent it out late because, you know, I'm pretty sure that the website used to have the English Rashi, but whatever. So, you know, anyway, so I apologize for that. Okay, let's move on. Here's the thing. I want to digress from our parsha for a moment to teach something slightly different because it's interesting and it's worth knowing, which is Rashi mentions here, quoting the Midrash, that the way that you should present the Torah to the people is Kishulchan Ha'aruch, like a table which is set. Now it happens to be that the word Shulchan Aruch, which I put in here in number 3 in your vocab, means set table. Now you may remember it from your Pesach Seder. Maror Korech Shulchan Aruch. It's really the same word, slightly different, right? Shulchan Aruch is the meal because it's set on the table, it's ready to be eaten. Shulchan Aruch is what we call the code of Jewish law. Most teachers, and probably myself also, whenever we say the Shulchan Aruch, the code of Jewish law, and everybody naturally assumes, well, that must be what Shulchan Aruch means, the code of Jewish law. But it doesn't, it means set table. And actually, if you want to really be nitpicky about it, the name of the book is something else. It has the book itself has its own name. But it is called the Shulchan Aruch. That's what we call the Code of Jewish Law. Now, the Code of Jewish Law, I gave you a very interesting little setup here. On this page, you see the four columns of Jewish Law? The four columns of Jewish Law were made up, were created by a guy named Rabbi Yaakov ben Asher. That was his name. He's a very interesting guy. He lived in the 1300s. He grew up in Germany, but the German Jews were expelled. He didn't grow up in Germany. I take it back. His father grew up in Germany. The German Jews were expelled in the early 1300s. All of Germany's Jews were expelled in 1304. And so his father, who was named the Rosh, Rabbeinu Asher, was expelled. And he grew up actually in North Africa. And he was a great halachist, the greatest halachist since Rambam, basically. And he wrote a code of Jewish law that he divided into four columns, kind of like a table, if you will. So he divided all of Jewish law into four columns, and he called the book Arba Turim, the four columns. It's for this reason that he is known as either the Tur, which means the column, which is kind of a name for a wrestler, but okay, you know, or the Baal HaTurim, the master of the columns. In any case, he divided up all of Jewish law, not all of Jewish law, all of extant Jewish law that is relevant in the diaspora. Okay? All of Jewish law relevant in the diaspora into four categories. I want to just sort of teach you basically the contours of what those four categories are, since we're talking about placing before people the Shulchan Aruch, like a set table. Here is the Shulchan Aruch. Now, after the Tur wrote this amazing commentary, an equally great man, a while later, Rabbi Yosef Karo, came and changed it. He modified the four columns and he wrote the book called the Shulchan Aruch. So there are actually two different books. The first book is the four columns, Arba Turim. It's called the Tur, T-U-R. And the second book is the Shulchan Aruch. But the Shulchan Aruch, the set table, is based on the Tur. Now the basic thinking behind the Shulchan Aruch was that he would take all of Jewish learning, the Torah, the Midrash, the Mishnah, the Gemara, the commentaries on the Gemara, the Rambam, all of Jewish learning for over 1,000 years, 1,500 years, he would distill it all and give you the quick and dirty answers to what the way we practice. Like a set table. He basically cut up the vegetables of the Talmud and cooked the meat of the commentaries and got it all ready and served it to you on a table. Here is the answer to how we practice. Not surprisingly, though, he apparently thought he did a great job, and he did do a great job. There are like a bazillion commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch. In fact, when you get the big Shulchan Aruch, I got one for my wedding. like it's like this big. And you open up the tome, and there's like three words of Shulchan Aruch, and it's surrounded by a million commentaries. So obviously there's a lot more to talk about since he wrote this. But it is a brilliant dividing up of Jewish law, and here's how it goes. There are four parts to it. Now, I gave it to you here in a chart, so you can actually, what I've done in the past is you can go through it all and write down all the different things that are in each column. We're not going to do that. We're just going to give a few examples. Okay? The first example, the first column, is called Orach Chaim, the way of life. And it is kind of like a day in the life of a Jew. It begins with waking up in the morning. You wake up in the morning and you say Moda Ani. It begins basically with waking up in your bed in the morning, and it concludes when you go to bed at night with the laws of Mariv, the laws of the nighttime prayer, and the laws of going to bed. Now in between, it covers all of daily life, meaning it covers washing your hands in the morning, putting on tzitzit and tefillin, it covers prayer, it covers the laws of a meal, washing your hands for a meal, eating bread, all the laws of blessings. It covers all the laws of the holidays, Shabbat, Pesach, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, the whole thing. It is a big chunk of Jewish law. But it's basically like a day in the life of the Jew, except all the different kinds of days that you could have. Now, I generally say that most of Orach Chaim is based around the synagogue. It's not completely true. It does deal with the home also. But it's very heavily synagogue-based. It has all the laws of prayer, reading the Torah. It deals with all the different kinds of prayers on all the different festivals. It's kind of heavy on the synagogue stuff. So when I think about it in a big picture, I say that this column is about what we would call synagogue Judaism. Okay? That's Orach Chaim. It's big. There's like 600, I forget exactly how many. There's about 600 sections in there. Takes a while to learn. The assumption, we sort of used to joke about this in rabbinical school, the assumption was that before you came to rabbinical school, you had mastered this. You knew everything in it. I still don't know everything in it. I mean, I'm working on it, but it's a lot of stuff. The assumption is, by the time you come to study, by the time you start medical school, rabbinical school, you should already know this stuff. Okay. It's very practical. Number two, column two. Column number two is called Yoredeya. And I wrote, it's rabbinic knowledge. And the reason I wrote that is because Yoreh, if you'll remember, what does Yoreh mean?
Year.
Nope, that's Yirah. What is Yoreh? I'll give you a hint. When we talked about it, when Hashem tells Moshe what tree to throw into the bitter waters, we talked about this word. It says, Vayorehu Hashem eats. Hashem taught him. It's the word like Torah. Yoreh is like Torah. So it is the teachers. So this column of Jewish law is about those who teach knowledge. In other words, rabbis. So Yoredeya is what you study when you are in rabbinical school. What is included in Yoredeya? All the laws of kashrut. Like soup to nuts on kashrut. It begins with the laws of kosher slaughter. Deals with all the laws of milk and meat. And then it moves on to some other important topics that rabbis have to deal with. Some of the important things that are dealt with are the laws of mourning and the laws of nida. And these are major areas that are studied in rabbinical school. Like half of the Jewish law that you have to master in rabbinical school deals with kashrut, mourning, and nida.
Why would that be under marriage?
Good question. So I think the reason it's not under marriage is because it deals specifically with rabbinic questions, or there's a lot of rabbinic questions related to it. You ask a rabbi about it, whereas marriage and divorce are more about courts.
Legal, right?
Yeah, they're more legal. This is not so much legal, this is more like, it's actually a very private area of inquiry. Like, you know, if you're asking a question about that kind of thing, it's kind of very, you know, very private thing, whereas marriage and divorce is very public. Done in a court, legal proceedings. Okay, so that's two. Now, I generally think of this as home Judaism, because it's more about intimate things. All the laws of kashrut happen in your kitchen. Maybe not the slaughtering part, but you know, a lot of it happens in your kitchen, right? Nida is about something that's very intimate. It's about your home. A mourning, when you sit Shiva, you do it in your home. So I think of this as home-based Judaism. We've got synagogue Judaism and home Judaism. One of the issues we have, just as a general aside in American Judaism, is that Our home Judaism is much weaker than it ever was. The whole tradition of the home and the home instilling education and the home being a place of where you get your Jewish inspiration and education from has really weakened in America now. We tend to focus our energies on the synagogue. Right? We've really, the synagogue has sort of taken over Jewish life, which leads to a number of consequences, which I will not get into now, but tempted though I am. Okay. Third column is Choshen Mishpat. Now the whole thing is based, actually, Choshen Mishpat is the whole thing. The high priest, we'll learn about this in 2 weeks, the high priest had a breastplate that had four columns on it. Each one had a different stone, one for each tribe. Right? So it was four. It had four columns and three of three stones each, so it was 12 tribes. So this whole sort of schematic is based on that. But Choshen Mishpat means the breastplate of Mishpat, like Mishpatim, right? So Choshen Mishpat deals with justice, laws between human beings. If two human beings have a court case against each other, it deals with the laws of judges and procedure and evidence. Everything having to do with the way people relate to each other is in Choshen Mishpat. In other words, it is Judaism of the workplace. This is business law. You ask someone to watch something for you. You pay someone to do a job for you. All of those things are in Choshen Mishpat. So we've got our synagogue Judaism, we've got our home Judaism, and we've got our workplace Judaism. We pretty much covered all the bases. That's because our Jewish law doesn't only apply in the synagogue. It applies in your home, and it applies at your place of work. Where else do you go besides your home, the synagogue, and work? The gym. Well, we do not have a column for the gym. But that's because gyms were not good places in the times of the Talmud. But we do have one final column. This fourth column really is sort of connected in a certain way to Choshen Mishpat. It is specifically about marriage and divorce, in other words, about creating a Jewish home, but it's very legal. It's very similar to, like, you know, it has a lot of court stuff and documents, so it's kind of connected to Choshen Mishpat. The two of them together are what you study if you get an advanced rabbinical degree, which I do not have. Right? So every Jew is supposed to know Orach Chaim, the first column. Rabbis are supposed to know the second column, generally speaking. And then the third and fourth columns are studied by what are called dayanim, judges. You become a dayan, because it's, a lot of it is about court procedure. So as a rabbi, you can have a rabbinical degree that is yore yore, that you are allowed to answer halacha questions. And you can have a rabbinical degree that's yadin yadin, that you are allowed to judge cases. You're allowed to preside over a Jewish court. I can sit on a Jewish court if it's a simple Jewish court, but if it's a serious Jewish court, I'm not a dayan, I'm not a judge.
What percentage of rabbis have
like not many have the. It's like another 4 years. It's like another 4 years of doing it. You have to. It's like a postdoc, you know. So, but some rabbis have it. Some rabbis are able to do it. I would love to do it. And I mean, obviously, rabbis generally have to know some of these other areas, like. If you're going to perform a wedding, you probably have to know something about marriage law. And if you're going to perform weddings, you might end up having to do a divorce. So you'll have to know certain things. But rabbis do not specialize in it. Wow, it is late. I didn't realize how late it was. So I guess we will stop here. Okay. Have a great week, everyone.